And today we have a work session scheduled, Senate Bill 495, public hearing, Senate Bill 1230, House Bills 2040 and 2130. So why don't we go into the work session on Senate Bill 495. So Warren, did you have another plan?
No, I think so.
Okay. We do have Mr. Waters. Mr. Waters is ready. He's got his caffeine.
Caffeine?
You have in there. All right, Mr. Waters, could you bring us up to speed on 495, please?
Where is that? I could, Mr. Chair. Senate Bill 495, as you may recall from last time, required some changes in order to satisfy the parties who were interested. And you should have before you a set of dash 2 amendments, which revise the appeals procedures, obtain certain late filers and non-filers. And specifically what the dash 2 amendments do are they allow an individual who has failed to file a tax return when requested to now be able to file a correct return with the Department of Revenue. And the correct tax return may be filed at any time. There's no statute of limitations on that. Additionally, a correct tax return will thereby establish the taxpayer's correct tax liability. The Department of Revenue may then reduce its assessment of tax to correspond with the correct tax shown on the correct tax return. Refunds of overpaid tax will be made if the return is filed within 3 years of the original due date or within 2 years of the payment of the tax if that happens to be later. And if the Department of Revenue rejects the return as not being materially true, the individual may appeal that decision to the court. And finally, returns filed under this provision will thereafter be treated like any other tax return. And it should be noted that these Dash 2 amendments replace the original bill, and substantially what they are is House Bill 2132 inserted into and replacing Senate Bill 495 with some minor changes.
All right. I thank you, Mr. Waters. Senator Fisher is here. He has his name all over the original bill. So we'll see what he thinks about this substitute. Senator Fisher, we welcome you back.
Thank you, Chair Miller and Senator Smith. I'm not going to take hardly any time at all. I'm just going to say that, as I did before, I'm not an accountant, and I don't understand all the workings of this. And the accountants have got together, and Susan Browning with the Department of Revenue worked hard. And my understanding is it comes with something that's satisfactory to them. Also, I believe they've worked out and are going to drop the 25% figure in the Senate Bill 496, which makes it a moot question. You won't have to visit that any further. So I'm in complete support of the amendments, and I'm going to let Susan Browning talk to you about them and whatever else you wish to do with the committee. So I thank you for your time, and really appreciate the work that you've done on this.
Well, thank you, Senator. Any questions? All right. I appreciate you being here. Thank Susan you. Browning? Anything you can do to slow down this progress?
Mr. Chairman, members of the committee, probably, but I'll try very hard not to. I just wanted to echo what Senator Fisher said. We worked with Mr. Blumenthal and Mr. Collins, and we got a letter from Mr. Blumenthal. He has a copy of it he sent to you, I believe, Chair Miller, and to also Senator Fisher. He's in support of the Dash 2 amendment. The Dash 1 amendments were originally just the old House Bill 2132, and then Mr. Blumenthal made some additional changes, and that's why you have the Dash 2. I think Ed outlined the major provisions. I'd be happy to walk through the amendments if you'd like to to explain a little bit more about it or show you where the different provisions come into place. And in essence, it's pretty much what Mr. Collins and Mr. Blumenthal, the situation they explained to you and talked to you about and the relief they were seeking. And this is pretty much the same thing that they had in a different format to conform a little bit better with the tax laws as written. So that's Senate Bill 495. And as Senator Fisher mentioned as well, on Senate Bill 496, there was a concern about the provision that the Department of Revenue has on the cancellation of doubtful liability under our rule. We have the greater of 25% or $100, if you recall that. Mm-hmm. We have agreed to modify our administrative rule as soon as we possibly can to eliminate the 25%. We just have $100 as the criteria on that piece. I believe that meets the intent of Mr. Blumenthal and Senator Fisher, and that's exactly what's in Senate Bill 496. So we can do that by rule and don't have to send it through the legislative process, and we'd be delighted to do that. So I'd be happy to walk through this if you'd like, or whatever you wish.
Well, I'm satisfied. I've read it. It's fine. Excellent. Well, I appreciate that. There's one question I have for you. On your testimony before this committee on March 17th, in your letter, the second paragraph, you say the taxpayer may request a conference or file a written object with the department. What is a written object?
Mr. Chairman, members of the committee, should be objection. We don't really want written object.
I struggled with this for weeks, but now they've cleared it up, we can move on.
Thank you. Thank you.
That's the upfront work you're
starting. Yeah. All right, is there anyone else who wish to say anything during this work session on Senate Bill 495? If not, we'll close the work session. No, we won't close the work session. We'll go to Senator Wild, the Vice Chair, who moves.
I move
the dash two amendments.
Wow, I couldn't have said it better myself.
Senate Bill 495, is there a discussion? Is there objection? Hearing none, the amendments are agreed to. Senator Wild.
Thanks, Mr. Chairman. I move SB 495 as amended to the floor with a due pass recommendation.
Senator Wild moves Senate Bill 495 to the floor with a due as amended to the floor with a due pass recommendation. Is there a discussion? If not, the clerk would call the roll, please.
Senator Perez.
Aye.
Senator Hartung.
Aye.
Senator Starr.
Aye.
Senator
Aye.
Senator
Miller.
Both aye. Senate Bill 495 has been passed to the floor. We will close the work session on Senate Bill 495.
I think with all that upfront work, you'd be just here.
Either you or Senator Fisher. Thank you. We'll check and see if Senator Fisher would carry that bill. If he does not, then... I appreciate the Vice Chair's continuing commitment. All right, so we will now we have Senator Metzger is here, and he would like to take a shot at Bill 1230. So we will open a public hearing on Senate Bill 1230, and we will welcome the distinguished senator from the resort on the mountain.
Awfully close, Mr. Chair. Quarter of a mile, anyway. Mr. Chairman, members of the committee, for the record, my name is Rick Metzger, State Senator, District 14. I appreciate the opportunity to come and testify on Senate Bill 1230. Now, you have, first of all, a dash one amendment that has been or will soon be distributed to you, which, Mr. Chair, essentially is a gut and stuff of the bill that you have in front of you. The Senate Bill 1230, and it's...
And just
hold on.
You're
still waiting for those? Okay.
We don't have
them. Okay. Well, let me... I'll kind of go through the premise of it, and when you get to dash one. The main focus of Senate Bill 1230 in its original form, as you can see, was providing a $100 tax credit as an incentive for increasing organ donation in the state of Oregon. After discussing that with a lot of the parties, who were very excited about the concept and understanding the potential tremendous fiscal impacts, whatever. Also concerned about the fact that it didn't do a lot to raise awareness, which is the real issue in organ donation. After taking advice from those involved in that, have changed that significantly to providing just a checkoff box on the Oregon State tax return. out of about 13,000 deaths in Oregon every year, only about 4.4% ever turn out to be organ donors. Meanwhile, there's 1,500 people in the Northwest alone who are awaiting organ donation. That number is about 60,000 nationwide. And clearly there's a disconnect for many of those who want to be organ donors and the act of actual donation itself. Yet, you know, before Mothers Against Drunk Driving started their campaign of awareness, before Smokey Bear, you know, told us all that you're supposed to put out your campfires, and the awareness issue was really, really an important one in starting to change opinions, attitudes, as well as understanding of needs. But what we see in Oregon is a lot of people needing donation, a lot of people perhaps wanting to be donors, but disconnecting with that awareness. The policy in the state of Oregon is if upon the death of an individual at the hospital, if they do not have a driver's license that has clearly indicated they want to be an organ donor or have a certificate, then the family members are consulted and they then have to make that decision at that moment. So we think awareness is the real key issue, Mr. Chairman, in trying to raise the level of organ donation in the state of Oregon. The intent of the, do you have the Dash Ones now?
We do.
The intent of the Dash One amendments you have in front of you is to raise money for Oregon's procurement agencies, and we've already got a change, and we have a placeholder there we mentioned at Oregon Health Sciences University. It actually will be the Oregon Donor Program, and that would have to be done in the form of an amendment, but we put that as a placeholder until we found the appropriate organization. In order to find anything from public service on this to ads on the backs of the buses, whatever that would be the appropriate form of awareness. But by checking off the donor awareness fund box in the state tax return, money goes into that fund that will go toward the end of increasing the ultimate commitment that Oregonians have increasingly made to the gift of life. Now, April is Oregon and Tissue Donor Awareness Month, and I urge you, Chair and members of the committee, to pass this piece of legislation. We have some individuals here much more astute at the importance of organ donation than I am to testify in behalf of that with the Dash One Amendment. And if there's no questions, if there are, I'll take some. Otherwise, I'll turn it over to the experts.
Are there questions? The revenue impact, now this is on the original bill of $30 million.
That was on the original bill with the tax, which is why we changed it, Mr. Chair. That's why we decided not to do a tax credit, that the awareness would be more important to be funded by the taxpayers themselves. So. In fiscal, being fiscally responsible, we changed it.
Okay. We've got here 2.5 million licensed drivers, and we figure that about half have chosen this status. Is that your
That's true. About 1.2 million to share, and yet there seems to be, as I mentioned, a tremendous disconnect between the awareness of making sure that that knowledge being a donor is known at the time of death.
All right. Well, we thank you for your testimony.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman.
We have signed up Mary Jane Hunt. And Mike Seeley is also here. If you'd like to come together, that'd be great. You would both identify yourself and give us your testimony, we would appreciate that.
Chairman Miller, members of the committee, I'm Mary Jane Hunt. I'm the Executive Director of the Oregon Donor Program, and I'm pleased to be here today to talk to you a little bit about our organization. The Oregon Donor Program is a volunteer-based nonprofit organization dedicated to increasing awareness of the need for both organ and tissue donation. We were established in 1975. We have established a very remarkable collaboration with all of the procurement agencies in the state, which include the Lions Eye Bank of Oregon, the Oregon Eye Bank, Pacific Northwest Transplant Bank, Community Tissue Services, the Marrow Donor Program, and the Whole Body Donor Program. And we are the sole agency dedicated to increasing awareness in this state. I'm here today representing these agencies, but most importantly, representing the people in this state who are waiting for their life-saving or life-enhancing transplants. As Senator Metzger mentioned, currently there are over 60,000 men, women, and children waiting for organ transplants here in the United States, and 1,500 live here in the Pacific Northwest. There are thousands more who could benefit from tissues, which include bone, skin, ligaments, heart valves, and cornea. We're asking for your support today on the Senate Bill 1230-1, which is relating not only to increasing donation, but public education. The essence of this bill is to expand the resources so that we can reach more people. As Senator Metzger mentioned, there are 1.2 million people in Oregon who have demonstrated their support by coding their license with a G. Unfortunately, that isn't enough, and the perception is they are a donor and that's all they need to do. According to the United Network for Organ Sharing, which is referred to as UNOS, the waiting list has tripled since 1998, and during that time, over 30,000 people have died waiting for organs. Currently, there are about 12 people every day in this nation who die because of lack of organs. We're at a time where 85% of Americans favor organ and tissue donation, yet less than half have done anything about it. As I mentioned, by coding your license with a D or signing your donor card, most people think that's enough. It isn't. Our message has to get out that you have to tell your family, because even though the license and the donor card are a legal document, the requirements from the agencies who do the recovery of organs and tissues ask your family to sign a consent form. That allows them to deal with the family, but also allows them to obtain very important information, medical and social history. That allows an assurance that there isn't a risk to that potential recipient. Another study that was done indicates that when families are aware that their loved one had a donor card or signed driver's license and have had the discussion, they're very overwhelmingly in support of carrying out their wish. So that tells us that our message needs to increase and improve to get families to talk about their wish. The inclusion of a donor awareness fund on the state income tax will allow people an option to support an organization, a cause that many of them already are supporting. We have been in a challenging circumstance for over 25 years in being able to get our message out to as many people as we can to save lives. This would be one opportunity that would expand that. We are in support of the concept of the amendments. Again, the leading Oregon Health Sciences University, the Oregon Donor Program is a nonprofit organization, and our sole mission is to educate people in this state about the need for donation. I would welcome any questions, and I appreciate your time to this matter today. Thank you.
Thank you. Let's hear from Mr. Seeley, and then we will may have questions.
Thank you, Chairman Miller and members of the committee. I wish to be here this afternoon. My name is Mike Seeley, and I'm the Executive Director of the Pacific Northwest Transplant Bank, which is the federally designated organ procurement organization providing services to the entire state of Oregon, southern Washington, and southwestern Idaho. We provide organ donation services to hospitals in our designated area and participate in the federally mandated organ procurement and transplant network. I've been involved in donation and transplantation for the last 15 years, and I am here today to support Senate Bill 1230-1, which will provide a source of funding for public education about organ and tissue donation. Through the generous acts of the public, who are well informed that lives can be saved through the miracle of transplantation. Oregon is fortunate to have a model coalition that's been in existence since 1975, the Oregon Donor Program, which many of you are familiar with. ODP is a model to other communities. I continually have people from around the country calling to see if they can set up their coalition in a similar fashion. Their sole purpose is to educate the public about donation. Providing this additional source of funding along with the support our organization and others provide will make a difference in saving lives as the public is better informed about the option of donation. I would agree with Mary Jane Hunt about the conceptual amendment regarding the proper recipient of the funds being the established education program, the Oregon Donor Program, rather than Oregon Health Sciences University. My own experience gleaned from speaking with many donor families, those who have been informed and educated, have made a decision ahead of time, are the ones for whom donation is a natural decision. Senate Bill 1230-1 will go a long way towards advocating for donation before it's an event in people's lives. Support of this measure would go a great distance. And I appreciate the opportunity to be here today.
Thank you. Are there questions? Senator Wyden?
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. This has puzzled me for quite some time when I first signed on to the program on my driver's license. Is that the various ways of dealing with this, because right now the way we have it, even though I signed on, as pointed out in testimony, it's not binding in any way to have my organs be donated, and that bothers me, because technically speaking, at least at this time when I sign, I'm legally allowed to do that. And what I've always wondered is, why haven't we just dealt with statute in terms of, one, if you want to sign on to the program, having a next of kin have to also sign and give their consent at that time, so that it's assured at the time of my death that that consent will already have been given, or something of that nature. I mean, we've left it kind of in limbo land, hoping that the heirs will say okay if we can find them in the appropriate amount of time. And it seems to me we've kind of gone about this in the wrong way, that you probably should have some legally binding document at the time you sign into the program that would assure that I get killed on my way home tonight, and yes, you've got the organs you need. And why aren't we dealing with it in this way?
This is a good question, and it comes up frequently. From an advocacy perspective, the way we approach education with our client hospitals is to advocate for your position as a donor. There's a practical matter that we've experienced over the years, and that is the fact that we are, as other agencies, an outside agency to that facility where our activity happens in the ICU, in hospitals for organ donation. Tissue donation can happen throughout the hospital setting. We're dealing with the hospital's clients who are the patients. And our experience over the years has been where families have been neglected in the process. That negative experience translates much more rapidly than that which is positive. And this is a challenge. What we do now in education is try to affirm that decision of the donor. And there are many ways in which we do that, by teaching hospital staff and our own staff advocate for that position. Early on, the question might be, well, Mr. Smith, your loved one has signed a donor card. What do you think about that? The more practical way is to advocate for that donor. Say, Mr. Smith, your loved one has signed a donor card. We're here to carry out your loved one's wishes. Do you have any questions? We're working very actively in that way. Also, you may be aware that recently the conditions of participation for Medicare have changed throughout the country, and it's affected our hospitals here in the state of Oregon, in that there is a required call that must be made of every death to the agency. Preliminary call for imminent death for those patients who would be candidates for organ donation. They would be people in the ICU with a head injury. And those who have died, so that no opportunity is missed as far as the option for donation. That, coupled with a well-informed public, I think will go a long way to moving in the direction that allows for the donor's wishes to absolutely happen. Previous measures of presumed consent have not been that successful in other states. And there's been public relations disasters for hospitals and for families who are very angry over that. But we seem to be moving in a direction that advocates for the donor. I know it's not as strongly stated as you're signing the donor card.
Could I? Sure. Thank you. So one problem I've seen is having to deal with people I've known who have relatives or friends who are dying or have died. And it's funny, the rational thought that takes place while they're simply coexisting in some way, how that compares to the thought process that takes place when that person is dying or has died is like night and day, and I'm not surprised that we have trouble getting the donations because, in fact, you look at somebody you care about and say, well, I'm not sure I really want them getting dissected at this time and having those parts taken away. Whereas when they're out playing ball with you, it's not so hard to say, hey, they've got a great heart. That would be really good to have you in somebody else. And so if we don't take care of it while people are thinking in a rational way, it seems to me you're not going to have it happen nearly as often. And no amount of education is going to take away that pain that somebody feels when they've lost someone. I mean, they truly, my wife just lost her mother, and she was not thinking rationally, and she would even agree with me right now on that, so I can say it on the record, but the depression is such that there is not rational thought taking place, and of course, the organs are lost after a certain period of time. So I suppose you could deep freeze the people until somebody can make up their mind. I'm just trying to come up with a way where, because I just don't see sitting them down and holding their hand and saying, you know, somebody else could use their heart. Right at that moment, it's probably not the best thing to say to somebody. It's not going to be well taken.
Chairman Miller, Senator Wilde, if I might address that as well. Through the Oregon Donor Program, our education and awareness projects are looking at different ways to bring up the topic of organ and tissue donation. As many of you can well imagine, death is not the dinner time topic of choice. And if we can bring the topic to a point where it's dealt with prior to illness, prior to death, in a family setting, then we are ahead of the game. And one of the newest tools that the Oregon Donor Program has incorporated along with that donor card, we also issue a family card, which you give to your family as a reinforcement so they will know this is your wish. And in actuality, families, when they are approached at the time of death, who have had that prior discussion, do find comfort in being asked and being able to carry out that wish. And that donation does offer some positive in oftentimes a very tragic negative situation.
Question here. The chair. Now, this committee, at least several, have expressed the interest in perhaps limiting the checkoffs on our tax form. Now,
correct.
How would you see as chair this fitting into that scenario?
I was going to advance that after the question. It would be the hope of this member that a different funding source could be discovered. We've been in the midst of discussions of either eliminating the checkoffs entirely, which is probably not likely, but I think there's a sense of agreement perhaps that at the very least, if we were thinking about adding, you would go to a rotation of some sort. Because there is certainly there are a lot of deserving charities that are eliminated in the current process. And I know we have testimony coming that may tell us about the cost of adding another line, perhaps. No, I guess that's not coming. But that's something we're wrestling with. So I don't think you'd find anybody here who wants to deprive you of the opportunity to spread this message. I would, speaking for myself, encourage you to, if there's some other way we might accommodate you in terms of the source. Senator Starr.
A couple of questions. One, can you accept funds that are tax deductible?
Yes, we can. We are a nonprofit 501c.
The other question is, relates to testimony that you gave regarding the importance of some history relating to the deceased individual that might be important to the recipient. That information is collected from the family at the time of question of donor parts as well as possible. Is that right?
Yes, Senator Starr, and Chairman Miller, the process at the time of consent when families are approached and the family consents to donation, we're actually required to obtain quite a bit of information as much as possible about their medical social history. And that helps in the determination of where those organs may end up being transplanted in relation to the risk-benefit ratio for that person waiting. Is there something in the medical history we should know about that may contradict the possibility of donation or that we should be aware of in our management of the donor? And so we are very reliant on families to get that information. There are certain CDC guidelines, and for the tissue bank, they follow FDA standards. For organ donation, it's more time-sensitive, much more critical. So that criteria is going to be a little bit more liberal, but we do, where we can, try to obtain that information at that time. And generally, that's when we have time with the family to sit down and separate out the issues of they understand their loved one is dead, and now in a separate conversation, we ask about donation, and we ask these questions that be helpful.
All right.
Senator Starr?
You're following a form that's where you're filling in the blanks, you're checking off the, as far as this history is concerned. Is that something that might be advanced to the family prior or at the time a donor was making a designation that I'm going to be a donor?
And so that would be it would be innovative to have a lot of things ahead of time, but unfortunately, being the time that that decision is made and the time of death, any number of events medically could have occurred that we need to be aware of, relating to lifestyle, social background, had they had blood transfusions between that event. So it's a current real-time event. And staff and our agency actually go through an extensive training in how to sensitively ask those questions. Pretty much like when you go to donate blood. They want to know at the time of donation what your current status is. So we have to do it secondhand through the family.
All right. Any questions? Okay. Thank you both very much.
Thank you.
We appreciate the testimony. Susan Browning. All right. Thank you for that. Is there anyone else who wishes to testify on Senate Bill 1230?
Allowed not to comment on it?
If not, we will close the public hearing on Senate Bill 1230. We'll now move to a public hearing on House Bill 2040. Lizbeth, and we have Mr. Trey Hearn and Mr. Mangus. Well, we'll see what we can do about that. Do you want to give us a rundown of the bill?
I'd be happy to, Mr. Chairman.
All right.
For the record, I'm George Cahan, Josephine County Assessor, and today I'm representing the Oregon State Association of County Assessors. House Bill 2040 was introduced by former Representative Bill Markham at our request because we found that there was a small error in Senate Bill 1215, which was the implementation of Measure 50 last session. At the time that was drafted, let me back up and tell you that there are two kinds of veterans exemptions, property tax exemptions, and in our statute. One is for the service-connected disability, and the other for a disabled American War veteran that is not disabled because of service-connected disability. The non-service-connected disability veteran gets a little less exemption than the service-connected disability. in the drafting of 1215, they intended to and did on the service-connected disability increase the veterans exemption by 3% per year to keep up with the assessed values that was going up 3% a year. It was allowed to go up at least that, or no more than that amount. But they missed the other exemption and didn't allow for the indexing of that. So House Bill 2040 is merely to correct that and allow for the other exemption to be indexed by 3% a year, and of course it adjusts the dollar amount to make sure that they're held whole, if you will, and get the full amount of exemption that they would be entitled to had they started in 1998 as was intended. Most of the counties, and I didn't pull all of them, but I think at least I know most of the counties did go ahead and give the 3% increase this past year, and intend to do so again this year, even though the statute didn't say that particularly. The bill does one other thing, and that is that it says on section 4 that whatever the county did is okay, and so that we're going to have a bunch of appeals for a very small amount of money. And, of course, we are very interested in the part that says what we did was okay, too.
Mr. Mangus.
Mr. Chairman, members of the committee, for the record, my name is John Mangus. I'm director of the Department of Veterans Affairs, and I'm here to support House Bill 2040 with the amendments that came through. That brings the all of the dollar amounts in line with the Veterans Compensation Cost of Living Adjustment Act of 1998 that was passed by Congress last December, and everything looks good from there on for us.
All right. Are there questions? Thank you both.
Thank you
for your testimony. Ms. Beth, I think they did a nice job of telling us what we're doing.
Yep.
So, is there anyone else who wishes to testify on House Bill 2040? If not, we will close the public hearing on House Bill 2040. Open up a work session on House Bill 2040. I'm going to stand it a while.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. I'd move HB 2040 to the floor for defense recommendation.
Senator Wild moves House Bill 2040 to the floor with a defense recommendation. Is there a discussion?
Comment, Mr. Chairman.
Senator Beyer.
The bill does exactly what we intended to do last time. Apparently, we missed something.
We did some. You haven't been on that committee.
It's not bad that we've only had to do two corrections this time. That's pretty good.
All right. The clerk, call the roll, please.
Senator Hightower.
Aye.
Senator Starr.
Aye.
Senator Pilot.
Aye.
Vice Chair Miles.
Aye.
Chair Miller.
Both aye. House Bill 2040 is passed to the floor. Close the first session on House Bill 2040. Senator Starr would like to carry that bill. All right. Thank you. We'll now open a public hearing on House Bill 2130. And we have Mr. Waters. We have Susan Browning. Mr. Waters.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. House Bill 2130 comes to us via the House Revenue Committee, and what it does is changes certain administrative procedures relating to taxpayer conference decisions resulting from tax audits. If I could go on, I guess. It removes requirements that the Department of Revenue use certified mail to contact taxpayer regarding conference requests and decisions. It gives taxpayer the option to request correspondence via certified mail, if they so choose. It moves the requirement that additional items or documents must accompany the conference decision letter under the very same cover. It clarifies that the Department of Revenue may disclose other information, that is, in addition to tax return information, to an authorized representative of the taxpayer, as defined in Oregon statutes. Informs the Department of Revenue's recognition of an authorized representative through that definition of that recognized by the tax court. And it also specifies that the multi-state tax commission's alternative dispute resolution process is not subject to Oregon's dispute resolution rules in ORS Chapter 36.
All right. Susan Browning?
Thank you, Mr. Chair, members of the committee. For the record, I'm Susan Browning with the Department of Revenue. Ed walked through the provisions of the bill pretty much already. I have handed out to you a summary of the bill. Section 1 is the area that discusses the leash, you know, the certified mailing requirement. As the statute stands now, office decision letters are required to be mailed certified mail. That's about the only document we have within the department that's required to be sent certified mail, other than some warrants. And even the opinions and the decisions by the Magistrate Division of the Tax Court go regular mail. So we also get requests from taxpayers that they would prefer not to have to go down to the post office to pick up the certified mail. So they ask us to send it to them regular mail anyway. So what this does is basically delete the requirement that we have to use certified mail. But if the taxpayer wishes us to, we certainly will. We can do that. And then the second piece on Section 2, basically as the statute reads now, it says that the conference decision letter must be must include the refund or refund denial or notice of assessment. And that's really a workload issue about trying to get these different documents all compiled together and making sure the certified mailing date matches the date on the check and matches the other documents as well. So we asked under House Bill 2130 that basically that the refund check or the refund denial or the notice could be sent in a different envelope from the decision letter. Because oftentimes you do get your refund differently from separately or your correspondence differently from your check or your notice. So that's more in line with the way the other activities in the department are handled. Section 3, this is a clarification we've had some discussions with our attorneys on. It's not clear in the statute right now that we have authority to disclose other types of information beyond the tax return or report filed by the it's not real clear in the statute as it is what type of information we can provide or disclose. Under Section 3, basically, we're expanding it from taxpayer's income tax return filed or a copy of any report filed to include any other information the department considers necessary, which might include like an audit report or some correspondence or information we have. You should be able to share that with your authorized representative. You've given that person authority to represent you in your tax matters, so we think it's appropriate we'd be able to disclose your information and help resolve the issue that you're dealing with on your tax account. And it's not really clear right now that we have the authority to share any information beyond the tax return or your reports that you filed. Section 4 is a little bit along the same lines. As we've had more interaction with the tax court and the magistrate division, it's not clear, entirely clear under current law that if you designate someone to be your authorized representative with the tax court, that just flows through and is reflected with the Department of Revenue. You think that that's appropriate? If you said that this person can represent you in the magistrate division or the full tax court, that person's authorized to represent you. But under current statute, that's not clear. So we've been stopping basically and saying, we recognize that this is your attorney's authorized to represent you in the tax court, but would you go ahead and ask them to fill out this form so they're authorized to represent the Department of Revenue, too. Which kind of puts a little bit of a delay in the system and a little bit more paperwork and bookkeeping. So we worked with the Magistrate Division of Tax Court on that, and they're happy with that solution as well. And then Section 6, I think that we talked a little bit before about the Multi-State Tax Commission. One of the areas that they're getting into more and more and quite effectively is providing alternative dispute resolution, and two states are taxing a taxpayer differently, and the taxpayer's caught in the middle. We would like to participate more in this dispute resolution where the states sit down basically and resolve the issue together and try and solve it so the taxpayer can have a clear decision on that. It's not clear right now whether or not that process the Multi-State Tax Commission offers would be subject to Oregon's dispute resolution process as well. So we would like to clarify that should be separate because it's really a state-to-state type of engagement in the Oregon dispute resolution process. So that's the basic pieces of House Bill 2130. We really are just administrative changes to improve the efficiency for the department and also for the taxpayers and their authorized representatives. We all
questions. On the section 3, the clarifying the department may disclose tax information to an authorized representative. Can you give me a tax situation? What information would be available if the taxpayer may not be supplying to their authorized representative? You might have. Did you consider this?
Mr. Chair, members of the committee, as it reads now, really what can furnish the representative with is a copy of what the taxpayer filed with us, a copy of your return or of any report that you filed. It doesn't clarify that we could share with your authorized representative some of our information, like our audit papers or our audit worksheets or the information we've got that deals with your tax account. So this would allow us to share with your authorized representative information we have about you, what kind of things we found through our audit report and what kind of things we're looking at. So it allows us to share as much of our information with your representative as your representative can share your information with us. It's more of a two-way street way this works.
All right. We thank you. Are there other questions?
We do.
I'm sorry.
We do have, Mr. Chair, an amendment to House Bill 2130.
Okay.
That,
we're in a public hearing. Do you want to do that? Well, you can describe that now and we'll adopt the hearing.
Yes.
Go right ahead.
Okay. The amendment to 2130 is totally unrelated to the House Bill 2130, and it really bears back to House Bill 2137, the Reconnect Bill. As our attorneys were looking at some of the amendments that were made in the 2137, they had some concerns because there were not some date provisions put in there. And as you recall, with Reconnect, we tied to the Internal Revenue Code as of a date. So there were some areas, about 3 spots, where there were not specific dates that were mentioned. So our attorneys have been working with Legislative Council to come up with a solution to that, and Dexter Johnson came up with a better solution than our attorneys did, as far farther ranging one anyway, that basically puts in several provisions to define the reference made in the Internal Revenue Code. And he heard it really came about when you adopted the Rolling Reconnect Bill back in 1997. There were probably should have been some provisions made in there to make it clear that you are tying to the Internal Revenue Code for these definitions of taxable income, or if there are other provisions that are as of this date. And then each time you address Reconnect, you would want to change the date in that piece. So they're kind of a little omissions that came about really in 1997 when the permanent Reconnect came into place. And we just happened to catch them with these 3 little areas that came up as part of 2137. But Mr. Johnson and our attorneys are very concerned that this needs to be fixed to make sure it doesn't create any constitutional problems. So we ask that it be accepted as amendment to 2130.
All right. We appreciate that. Questions regarding?
We just talked about that 3 amendments.
Yep.
Thank you.
Thank you. Anyone else wishing to testify on House Bill 2130? If not, we'll close the public hearing on House Bill 2130. We'll open a work session on House Bill 2130. Senator Beyer.
Move the Dash 3 amendment.
Senator Beyer moves the Dash 3 amendments to House Bill 2130. Is there a discussion?
Dash A3.
The Dash A3 amendments. To House Bill 2130, is there a discussion? Is there objection? Hearing and seeing none, the amendments are agreed to. Beyer moves.
Move House Bill 2130A as amended.
Senator Beyer moves House Bill 2130.
Any recommendation?
As amended to the floor with a?
Do pass
recommendation. Is there a discussion? If not, the first to call the roll.
Senator Stern.
Aye.
Senator Beyer.
Aye.
Senator Harrison,
Vice Chair Lyle. Aye. Votes aye. House Bill 2130 is passed to the floor. We'll close the work session on House Bill 2130. We'll thank Senator Beyer for sharing this. Is there anything further to come before the committee? If not, we are adjourned.